So we have been working through the book of Acts. We got through chapters 22 and 23 last week. I'll do just a little bit of a quick survey of those because we want to get to chapter 24 today. And as we come closer to the end of the book of Acts, we're going to see a lot of things about the church and the way it moved that may open up some questions that we have about churches today and the legacy that we have. Any questions about what we covered last week or anything before we get started? Anything that came up or anything if you've read those chapters? Okay, so before we start today, I want to just want you to think about a time in your life. Hopefully it's now, but maybe it's at the other time, when you were most productive for the Lord. You know, and I realize when I say that, I'm using human context for productivity. You know, we all have a time sooner or later we reach an age where we say, well, we're going to let the younger ones do it. We've been there, done that. We're going to back off and do some other things. Some of that is certainly natural, but I won't go through all the legacy of prophets who didn't start their work until they were 80 years old to guilt you into doing anything. But I just want you to think about the time when you were most productive in your life. Because I think that the lesson today gives us a little bit of insight into the way God works differently than the way we think. And of course, that is a theme throughout the Bible. God works in mysterious ways. We don't always understand them. We don't always appreciate them. But as we look back over time, or we look through the prism of history, we can see benefit, and we see that with the Apostle Paul. But I know that there are times when we feel like we've been on a mountaintop with God. We've done a lot of work in His kingdom. We've been very productive. And then there are other times when we feel like the world has passed us by. We're not doing anything. We're not active any longer. We don't feel like we're being productive. We get discouraged. And I know that affects all of us. It affects me. I know it affects all of us, you know, as we try to labor. And I want you to think about that as we go through. If I remember, I'll point out some things as we go through the study of Acts and talking about Paul. So Paul, through his experience, we know, just to set the stage for this, Paul, through his experience, was on the road to Damascus, had the encounter with the Lord, was blind, had to be led to the city. A disciple there ministered to him, restored his sight, and also told him that God would tell him what to do. In the book of Acts, we see Luke gives pretty short description to a lot of time that Paul spent, nearly 3 years in Saudi Arabia and in Damascus, getting straight in his mind what God wanted him to do. He knew that God wanted him for some special mission. And at the end of that time, he went to Jerusalem, had a big problem there, got out of town real quick, and moved back to where God called him, which was to be a minister to the Gentiles. And he labored for most of his career in the mission field. And you can look in your Bible, most all of them have maps of Paul's first, second, and third missionary journeys, and you can read all about those in the book of Acts, which we've studied, or in the books of, you know, that he's written about the various places, you know, Ephesus, Philippi, Corinth, Rome, all the places where, you know, he spent time, Thessalonica. So you can read kind of amplifications of the book of Acts about what he did there, the extent of the problems in these various churches. And so it's important to get a context for Paul. But now Paul's come to the end of a time for him. And he was on a trip back to Jerusalem. He was being compelled by the Spirit to go to Jerusalem. And he went back through many of the churches to collect a love offering for the church in Jerusalem. As I mentioned before, the church in Jerusalem was very poor. And the reason it was very poor is because there were a lot of converts that weren't wealthy. And the converts that were wealthy and converted openly were kicked out of the synagogue. Many times they were denied jobs because that was not looked upon kindly by the Jewish authorities that ran the city. So the church was fairly poor, and so they needed desperately to be funded. And so Paul collected several times missionary love gifts to take back for them. And this is one occasion. But he also was being compelled by the Spirit to go back to testify in Jerusalem. And we've seen that in the last couple of weeks. We've looked at that. And Paul has gotten himself into trouble. He testified. He went back this time. The Jews were waiting for him. And he got into trouble. And they tried to kill him. The head of the Roman troops there rescued him from being killed because of the riots, discovered he was a Jew, and also a Roman citizen, knew that he was on thin ice because he was about to flog him and put him in prison illegally. So he decides to send him off to Caesarea, which is the Roman provincial governor's group up along the coast. On this tour, we'll go to Caesarea and you'll see the ruins. In fact, when we do that part of the Bible study, I'll show you pictures of the ruins there, and you'll see in vivid detail the place that Paul is during this time of the book of Acts. And so he's sent there, and the governor Felix hears his case, and that's where we pick up today. Felix is hearing his case about the Jews. So turn in your Bibles to Acts chapter 23, because I'm going to read a few verses as we bridge into 24. And then we'll begin 24. So I want to begin in chapter 23 in verse 33. So let me read about this. I'm going to begin in 31. So when the commander in Rome decided to send Paul to Caesarea, a commander in Jerusalem, I'm sorry, decided to send Paul to Caesarea, he knew that there was a plot by the Jews to kill him. And so what he did was he gathered about 500 or 600 troops, both cavalry armed walking foot soldiers, to escort him on horseback all the way to Caesarea. So verse 31 says, so the soldiers, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. Antipatris is about 25 miles or so outside of Jerusalem. So the cavalry goes that far until they're away from Jerusalem. It says, the next day they let the cavalry go on with him while they returned to the barracks. So the armed foot soldiers came back, and so the cavalry took him on horseback for the additional 20 or 25 miles it takes to get to Caesarea. So Caesarea is a little over 50 miles from Jerusalem. And if you're familiar with a map of Israel, you go towards Galilee, and it's on the coast, up on the Mediterranean coast in the northern part of Israel is where Caesarea is. And we'll go see that. When the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor and handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear your case when your accusers get here. Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. So Herod the Great, always an interesting name for him, but there were multiple Herods. Herod the Great was the one that finished the temple in Jerusalem, built the city of Caesarea in honor of the Roman Caesars, was a builder. He built a lot of things in the land of Israel. You know, he built a lot of what they call the Decapolis, which were cities that were established by Greeks, and they built small Roman cities throughout the northern part of Israel. I'm not sure whether one of those is on the tour, but there's a number of them that are still dramatic in their ruins, that you can see the evidences of the Roman Colosseums and the Roman walkways and the Roman baths and all those. So this guy Herod was a great builder. But he's gone. He died a long time ago, and there's the third Herod is now ruling Jerusalem in the aforementioned territories right now. We'll see how he connects to this story in a minute. So they take him. You can read the letter back in Acts 23 that the Roman commander sent, but they send him to the Roman governor, Felix, who is up in Caesarea. So chapter 24, 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus. And they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. It's interesting because we think about Rome. Rome was an empire ruled by laws. The Pax Romana was the peace of Rome, Roman peace, and they kept that steady and peace. They had Roman laws which they enforced. Now, there were crooked Roman rulers, just like there are crooked rulers in every generation, in every country. But by and large, they were a law-believing area, especially Roman law for Roman citizens. They really didn't care a whole lot about what laws were broken for the native inhabitants of the land that they conquered, like the Jews or like the Philistines or like the Assyrians, but they cared a lot about the Roman citizens, and it was important in terms of law. So 5 days later, which is not a long time, because probably the next day, it probably took at least a day for the Jews to figure out that Paul had escaped their clutches. And when they did, they decided that they had to go to make their case in Caesarea. So, they picked their lawyer, and their lawyer had to be somebody familiar with not only Jewish law, but also familiar with Roman law to plead the case. And Luke runs through this pretty quickly, but I want to talk about some things as regards this case when we get to it. So the elders, so the high priest goes, some of the elders, which means some of the religious leaders of the day, went with them, and a lawyer named Tertullus, and they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. Now we see probably a lot of typical things here from attorneys. The first thing, we don't have any attorneys in here, do we? Okay, good. So the first thing we see is they flatter the judge, trying to gain some position of sympathy for their clients. So Tertullus presents his case. He says, "We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix, we are acknowledging this with profound gratitude. But in order not to weary you further, I would request that you be kind enough to hear us briefly." Now, let me just make a little parenthetical comment. Romans were really annoyed at Jews most of the time. They were so particular about little tiny things in their laws. They caused no end of grief to the Romans. So they try to butter him up, and then they try to say, "Just give us a brief moment to tell you our case," in hopes that he will take that and do kind of summary judgments and move on, but he doesn't. And he says, "We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He's a ringleader of the Nazarene sect, and even tried to desecrate the temple. So we seized him." I want to stop here for a minute, because there's three charges they make here. And if you pay attention to the charges they did back in Jerusalem, you see these charges are a little different. These are charges that they hope they don't have to actually stand and declare witnesses for, because they have no evidence against Paul. So they're trying to make their charges ones that Felix will bow off on easier. So their first charge is a charge of troublemaking. So it's a personal charge to Paul. He's a troublemaker. He causes problems wherever he goes. There's no place he goes that he does not stir up trouble. Well, I mean, if we are an honest reader of the Gospel of the New Testament, we'd have to say Paul does do that. In fact, if you've ever heard of a guy named Vance Havner, who's an old-time preacher in the evangelical church, he made the statement that says wherever Paul went, there was either a riot or a revival. So some of this is true, but it's a personal charge. It really has nothing to do with why they're there, other than, how in a jury trial, the lawyer tries to discredit the witness and discredit anybody who's going to testify for them to make it, to lessen their testimony. So this is the attempt here, typical lawyer stuff, trying to discredit Paul, make him appear as a troublemaker, to make any leanings of the Roman court to be against him from the beginning. First charge is a personal charge. Troublemaker, stirring up riots all over the world. Gives Paul a lot of credit here. All over the world he's stirring up trouble. Then we get to what you would call a political charge. He's a ringleader of the Nazarene sect. This is a political charge, and the reason why this is important is because the Roman Empire tolerated Judaism and allowed them to practice their religion, but no other religion could start without express approval of the Roman Empire. At this point in time, Jerusalem still stands, it's not 70 AD yet, and the Romans thought that the Christian faith, or the way as Paul calls it here, was a part of the Jewish faith. All the believers were Jewish, at least predominantly, in the early church. And they were Jews that had become Christians. And so they thought of it not as a new religion, but as a part of the Jewish religion. Therefore, it was tolerated and left alone. This is the proclamation by the lawyer that it's a religious sect. And we know, just in our own English term, the term sect typically means something carved out, looks like something else, but isn't something else. I mean, we look at various, we have another name we call some of those, and that's cult. Cult and sect are similar, except cult has a more pejorative ring to it. It has more of a ring of outside the mainstream, maybe a little wacky in some respects. And so they say it's a sect. And not only is it a sect, which is illegal, but as the ringleader, he's the one fomenting this sect and causing trouble. Now, they don't mention James. They don't mention any of the leaders of the church in Jerusalem. They mention Paul. And why? Because Paul is preaching grace and not law. And they don't like that. They don't like that one bit. And so, you know, they're going after him. Besides, he was one of them as a Pharisee, and now he's, you know, not one of them. So they go after him. And then they come after him with a religious charge that he tried to desecrate the temple. Now, if you go back and look earlier in this narrative, the earlier charge was, you know, he was doing trouble and destroying the temple and doing other stuff. So now the term is desecrate, which really means dishonor the temple. And, of course, what they mean here is, as you recall, their charge was that he had brought Greeks into the temple. And, of course, that was forbidden. Certain point in the temple structure, you get past the court of Gentiles. You had to be a Jew. And you get past the court of Gentiles and the court of women, where you had to be a Jewish woman. Nobody that was not Jewish could pass either one of those and go any further. And because they'd seen Paul associating with various Greeks that were Christians, never in the temple, but they assumed that he had brought them in, which he never did. But they assumed that, and so that's the basis of their charge here, that he had brought a Greek into the temple and therefore dishonored the temple, desecrated the temple, made it unclean, and so forth. So that's their charge. And so we seized him. Now my Bible skips verse 7 and goes to verse 8. It doesn't have a verse 7. Yours may have a verse 7. And let me tell you what verse 7 is, and it's in some manuscripts and some it's not. Verse 7 says, some manuscripts add after him and wanted to judge him according to our law. In other words, we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. But the commander Lysias came out with the use of much force and snatched him from our hands and ordered his accusers to come before you. So they impugn here Lysias, who's the commander in Rome, saying we were operating within our law. He desecrated our temple, and because of that we seized him, and we were going to try him under our law, which of course is a lie, and they were actually going to kill him right there in the courtyard with no trial, no anything. And why it's in some and why not, I don't know, except to say a lot of the Bibles, especially the newer ones, tend to go with the verses that are in the oldest manuscripts because those are viewed as more accurate. Yet because this doesn't contradict anything and really expresses the intent of the Jews, my Bible has it as a text note. So you see the lawyer here spinning his wheel because Lysias, the commander, has not come to offer a defense. And without a defense, the only thing that Felix has is the letter from the commander. Now, the letter from the commander is pretty interesting because it says he's a Roman citizen. The Jews do not have the right, even if he's a Jew, to seize a Roman citizen and try him and flog him and beat him. So they're out on a limb here, but they don't know all that Felix knows. They just kind of know they've got an opportunity here and they try to press it forward. And then they say, by examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him. And the Jews joined in the accusation, asserting these things were true. So you can see, you know, a panel of these guys standing here, the lawyer making his case, and the high priest and the others nodding their head, going, you know, whatever they do, that's the way it is, that's the way it was, we agree with that. All the things that they do to build the case and make it look like a groundswell of activity. And then verse 10, when the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied. So Felix was listening to this, but this is an open case. So he's going to hear from the accuser, then he's going to hear from the accused. So he motions for Paul to speak, and Paul steps up and speaks. We will actually see, and you'll stand on the platform where this all took place, if you are on this, or if you ever go to Caesarea, because it's very clear. The structure's gone, but the floor is there, and you can see the structure where court was held and where the flat piece is, where Paul made his case, and where the areas are where people stood around, kind of the gallery, if you will, stood around and watched judgments take place. So kind of fascinating to read this story. So Paul replied. You'll notice Paul's different here. He doesn't flatter Felix, but he does speak some truth to Felix, and I'm sure Felix appreciated the fact that he wasn't being buttered up by Paul. He says, I know for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense. In other words, you've been a fair and honest judge, and therefore I'm glad to make my defense. No buttering up, no any of that stuff. You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. Again, I've said this before, but you'll see this up to Jerusalem, down to Caesarea. All of that has to do with the way the Jews viewed Jerusalem as kind of the center of the universe. And when you went to Jerusalem, I don't care where you went from, you went up to Jerusalem. When you left Jerusalem to go somewhere else, you went down from Jerusalem to go there. Even if it was higher in altitude or lower in altitude, you went up to Jerusalem and down to Caesarea. So Paul makes the case that 12 days ago, he went up to Jerusalem to worship. Now you recall that Paul went and you know, he spent one night there, and James and the brothers thought that he was probably going to be come after by the Jews. So they hatched a plan where he would go and go into the temple and pay for a Nazarite vow to be done by people who were thankful for something God had done in their life, to have their heads shaved, to pay that, to do the penance with them, to do whatever it took in the 7 days to complete that vow. So Paul was in the temple. He was there for a couple days. He was in the temple for 7 days to complete that vow, just with those other four men. And he completes that vow, and that's when the whole problem occurs. So now it's 5 days to be up in Caesarea, because it's taken that long for him to be heard. So he says, you can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogue or anywhere else in the city. So he answers very quickly the charge of troublemaking. The charge of troublemaking, the charge of riots, the charge of anything they would be eyewitnesses to. Now, they hadn't brought any of these Asian Jews who had seen Paul up in Asia Minor. And so they had no right to accuse him of anything he'd done up there, only the right to accuse him of what they'd seen personally in Jerusalem. And then he says, in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city, and they cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me. However, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. So Paul doesn't deny the Lord. He affirms his belief in the Lord, and he affirms that he is part of this movement called the Way, which they call a sect. He doesn't give that any weight, but he calls, you know, they call it a sect. And then he goes on to define what that is. And you'll see how wonderfully the Spirit gives Paul the words to say. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets. And I have the same hope in God as these men, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. So what he's basically said here is, I believe the Old Testament. I believe the God of the Old Testament. I believe Jehovah is my God. I believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I believe in the prophets. I believe in all that they've said and done. I believe all of the law. And I have a hope, like they had a hope, of the resurrection of the dead, all of which is taught very clearly in the Old Testament. Now, the Sadducees, of which the high priest was one of those, was not a believer in resurrection. So they only believed in the law of the Torah. They didn't believe the prophets, so they didn't believe in, you know, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and the prophets who talked about this resurrection. So they weren't believers in the resurrection at all, which is kind of interesting. I don't know what their hope was, you know, but they didn't believe in the resurrection. So there was always a dispute between the Pharisees who did and the Sadducees who didn't. But anyway, he makes his point, and his point is that he strives to keep his conscience clear. In other words, keep away from anything sinful before God or before any man. He tries to do his best to honor God's will. So these personal charges are being put away. The charge of leading a rebellious sect and starting trouble has been put away. And now he comes to the last charge. And he says, after an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. I was ceremonially clean. As I mentioned, he had gone through that ceremony to become clean. When they found me in the temple courts doing this, there was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. For these who are here should state what crime they found in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin, which was nothing, by the way, if you recall that from the book of Acts earlier. Unless it was this one thing, which I shouted as I stood in their presence. Yeah, I remember that Vance Hafner comment about either a revival or a riot. Paul couldn't leave it alone here. At the end, he has to make his point clear, and it is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today. So now this argument, which has gone on forever between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, he now brings back into sharp focus in front of Felix. You know, of course, Felix knows a lot about the Jews, and we'll know why in a minute. Then Felix, who is well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings and says, when Lysias the commander comes, I will decide your case. Now, it's not clear to me whether Lysias ever came back. And Paul languishes up there in the prison for a couple of years, and we'll see that. And so my point to you earlier was, think of a time when you were productive, and think of a time when you feel like you're being put on the side. You're pulled over into the sidelines somewhere. You're waiting on God to show you your next assignment or, you know, give you something, you know, to do. And that's really where Paul is now. Paul is in prison now. House arrest, but under house arrest for about 2 years after this time. And so we see Paul's not up in the mission field. He is in a mission field, but a different one. He's been called by God to do something very particular for him, to close out his ministry. Verse 23, he ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit the friends to take care of his needs. So he was under house arrest, but all of his companions could come and go. Luke could come and go. All the companions that came with him could come and go. They could bring him food. They could pray together. They could worship. They could do whatever they were doing. He just couldn't leave. He had to stay there. Most likely, he had a guard with him all the time, maybe chained to him. Guards would change every 6 hours, but he was pretty much free to do what he wanted to do within the confines of Caesarea. Several days later, Felix came with his wife, Drusilla. I'll add new wife to Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Jesus Christ. The one thing you got to say for Paul, wherever he was, whether he was in prison or whatever, he was not quiet about the Lord. He spoke what God laid on his heart. We see it, you know, in prison in Rome, he wrote many of the letters that we see in the New Testament from a cell in Rome. Here he's, every opportunity he gets, he preaches the gospel to Felix. Drusilla, let me tell you a little bit about her. Drusilla is the granddaughter of Herod the Great. She is the niece of the Herod who killed John the Baptist. So she has more than a passing understanding of both Jewish law and the way. She understood the way. She was around during this whole time of Jesus' ministry. She was the youngest of the children of Agrippa, her father, and she was, according to Josephus, if you ever read Josephus, who was a Jewish historian, who wrote during the day, she was the most beautiful of the women in the family, and you know, much sought after. Her father tried to marry her off to a guy named Antipas, if you remember him, who was the ruler of Syria at the time, one of the actually the prototype of who we would call the Antichrist today, Antiochus, extremely violent. But he had to become a Jew, and he wouldn't do that. So she never got married off to him. So at about 15, she got married off to some king who was friendly with her father up around where Paul was from, up around Cilicia. And she married him at 15 years old and moved up there, became a queen. But for whatever reason, Felix determined she was going to be his wife. So she got him, well, this guy became a Jew, got circumcised, followed the law, and she divorced him. Not legally, but she divorced him and married Felix. I don't know what Felix promised her. I don't know anything about that. But she's about 21 or 22 years old now. Very familiar with the law, very familiar with all things about it, very familiar with this sect, this Jewish outgrowth called the Way, or the Christian movement, as we would call it. So she's come along with him now. So they're just married, and now Felix is the governor, and she's up there, and she comes in to hear him. So they're sitting, and if you look at some of the paintings of this, you know, all obviously done by the early church painters, you'll see Drusilla sitting off to the right of Felix, and Paul there, and you know, making this case. So Paul spoke to them about faith in Jesus Christ. So Paul, you know, never misses an opportunity to witness. As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come, Felix was afraid. So Paul doesn't mince words here. He talks about three things. He talks about righteousness, in other words, being right before God, doing the right thing as God would see it. And that righteousness, of course, is not Felix. Felix is not done right by God at all. Felix is an unrighteous man. Doesn't last too long. He only lasts, well, this 2 years that Paul's in prison, he lasts that long, and then he's recalled to Rome. And he's recalled to Rome for this reason. He becomes friends with some of the Assyrians who are in the northern kingdom, probably because of the relationship with Drusilla. And because the Assyrians are always fighting the Jews there, this is up in the Galilee and the Golan Heights and all that region today. And in that region, when they had battles, he would protect the Syrian households from the Jews, but he wouldn't protect the Jewish households from the synagogue, from the Assyrians. So they were rampaging, pillaging, stealing everything, robbing the Jewish households blind. And finally, the Jews had had enough, and they brought charges against him to Rome for theft, for not following the law, and that was a serious matter. And it was so serious a case that they recalled him to Rome. He doesn't mention that here in Luke, but you read that if you read the other Gospels and you read some of the secular history, you see why he was recalled, because he was basically corrupt. So this discussion about righteousness hit him hard, right between the eyes. And then he had the discussion of self-control. And of course, self-control here means being obedient to the will of God, following God's will, even when it's not your will. And of course, that hits Drusilla pretty hard as well. So they're not real happy with this as he's preaching. And then he talks about the judgment to come. He talks about how we all, great and small, will face a resurrection, how all will be raised and stand before the Lord, and will be judged on our works if we're not saved, will be judged on our salvation if we are saved, will be in the book of life. He gives them the full dose. Felix got afraid. He didn't like it. The word here really means he began to tremble with fear. So you can imagine, if you've ever heard a preacher or an evangelist or somebody speak, and you became so agitated with it because of something in your own life you had to deal with, that was really Felix at this moment. And I'm sure between Felix and Drusilla, the looks passed, and that was the end of this conversation. Because it says, that's enough for now, you may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you. And if you go read in the book of Hebrews, you see where convenience was really a missed opportunity for Felix. He had the Spirit pulling on him. He had the time perfectly right to accept this new way, to be forgiven of his sins and go forward. But he doesn't do that. He hardens his heart, he walks away, and you see where it takes him. And it's further into this distance away from God. And so he doesn't send for him, certainly to learn. Verse 26, at the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, which Paul doesn't do. So he sent for him frequently and talked with him. But I'm sure he talked about everything except salvation. You know, he was trying to make Paul give him some money to get him out of jail. Kind of interesting. Verse 27, when 2 years was passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. So the backstory here is, he was accused by the Jews of showing favoritism, violating the law, robbing them of their rights and their protected status as Jews in the Roman kingdom. He was called back to Rome, which is a very serious charge for a Roman procurator to be called back. And he was going to have to face the Jews in a court of law. He was going to have to face their accusers of what they did. And they had plenty of witnesses against him. Plenty of witnesses. So as a way to sort of make it easier on himself, he thought, he decided to leave Paul in prison because the Jews didn't like Paul, and he was trying to give them one last favor to build his case before he goes and stands before them. Paul is now left in prison for 2 years, and the guy who replaces him is a guy named Porcius Festus. And I'm going to stop here because we'll read about him in chapter 25. We'll see Festus is orders of magnitude better than Felix in terms of administering Roman law, in terms of being faithful. He was a son or son-in-law of a very high official to Caesar. So, this was probably a plum appointment to be sent down there to Caesarea. Beautiful city, by the way, on the Mediterranean, beautiful weather. Pretty peaceful in all regards because it had a large Roman contingent. So it was kind of a plum assignment that Festus got to move there, and I'm sure he was grateful for that. We'll read about him. So I guess the point I want to make here, and I want to come back to my original discussion. Paul spent 3 years in Saudi Arabia, put on the sideline by God to clarify his role of what God wanted him to do. But when Paul understood his role, when Paul understood his call from God, he went after it with fervor. Everywhere he went, he defied danger. You can't say Paul was afraid of anything. You know, he stood in the face of the angry crowds in every city he was in, both in the Greek areas, in the Roman areas, certainly in the pagan areas, and now, you know, back in his home city, not birth city, but home city of Jerusalem, where a lot of his people were. He was ridiculed. He was stoned, practically stoned to death. He was practically drowned in a storm. Many of the sufferings of Paul you could look at as almost like Job. I mean, not as bad as Job, but certainly a standout in terms of suffering for the faith. Paul always looked upon them as being put on the sideline for some new assignment for God. Now, Paul's assignment, he knew, was to bear witness in Jerusalem and to bear witness in Rome. So Paul's overall mission is to bear witness in Rome, and he knows that. And we'll see how that begins to unfold in this next chapter. So Paul is on the sidelines for 2 years here, and then he's on the sideline for several more years in Rome. And you just see God's priorities sometimes are not our priorities in terms of our ease and way of life. And I think about people I know in the ministry who are in the ministry for a while, then out of the ministry, not by their own choosing, but for other reasons. And they're waiting on assignments from God. And it's not uncommon for that to happen. In fact, the great men of God, I mean, Moses spent 40 years down in Midian before his call to God. So it's not uncommon. I hope none of us have to spend 40 years in the desert to hear from God. But it's not uncommon. So my point is, if we're in a place where God has moved us to the side, or we don't feel like we're doing what we think is the right thing, God has another plan for us. We just have to be faithful and follow what He gives us to do every day. I always tell people, and I've mentioned to many of those that I've counseled who are waiting for God to speak to them, you know, waiting for a new word from God, that many times you don't get the road to Damascus experience from God. But if you read His Word is the legacy of His spoken voice to us. So His Word is the Word to us. Whatever He tells us in here to do is what we should do. Because if we're not doing this, why would we do anything extra that He gives us to do? If we're faithful to do this, He'll give us assignments to be faithful. So my call to you and to myself is, as we go through those times, and we all do, when we got to the study of Gethsemane, you know, we talked about we all have a Gethsemane in our life. If we're Christians, we all have a Gethsemane. We come to a point where we have decisions to make about not our will, but God's will. And the choices we make may not affect our salvation, but they do affect the quality of our ministry for God here. And so we need to just be careful about those. Any thoughts or questions, any things about this that perhaps jumped out at you today that I didn't cover? Okay. So thank you for coming. Please say hello to our two guests that are here, and our repeat guests that are here. And welcome them. And next week we'll do the next chapter, so read ahead if you will, and we'll do that. And maybe we'll get a little further along in the book of Acts. You'll have to help me think about where we go next too, what we do after this. So let's have a word of prayer. Lord, we thank You for this time. We thank You that You're a God who loves us. You're a God who ministers to us. And Lord, even though we follow You and we try to be obedient, we understand, Lord, that we can't be perfect in this regard. And we always need to seek Your forgiveness. We always need to come to You and seek a path back to Your way. Lord, we also know that even in harm's way, if we're in Your will, we are where You want us to be. I think about the missionaries there on foreign soils. I think about Paul. I think about others who take Your path, even though it's a path that puts them in physical danger. Lord, there's no place better for any of us to be than in Your will, wherever You've called us to be, doing whatever You've called us to do. Lord, I pray for the service to come. I pray for the pastor as he gives us Your word. I pray that You'll lay it on his heart to preach it the way You've called him to do it. Lord, I pray that all the music, all the praying, all the other stuff that we go through in the church will all be done to your honor and glory. And Lord, the people who come to hear, it will meet a need in their heart today. Lord, I pray for your spirit to be in attendance and move in this service. And I pray in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you all.